else except me with the bill, so we might as well start. We're already 7 minutes here. Well, I guess we don't have anybody. Okay, we'll just take up House File 2520, Lake Spirit Zoo Poplar Bear Exhibit Expansion during funding provided, funds, bonds issued, and money appropriated. I would like Kevin Wally, who represents Duluth, presented to say a few words, and then we're waiting for other authors. The other authors are not here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Wally, and I represent the City of Duluth. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a little background information on this request from the city. The Lake Superior Zoo is in need of some corrections and improvements in order to restore their accreditation with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. There's been some general wear and tear on the facility that several of the buildings and the systems for the buildings and the exhibits require some fixing up. And so this request would provide matching funds for the city to upgrade their facilities generally and to restore their accreditation. And the importance of that is it's a very important seal of approval and would remove limitations on the zoo in terms of attracting or bringing in new replacement animals for the various exhibits. So if you have questions, Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to respond, and I have some materials I can leave with the committee.
Yes, and the project is already, I mean, the plans are made already, and there'll be a local match. This is 2,180,000.
That's correct, and there is a list of specific improvements which have been generated by the city and zoo staff.
Okay, good. Any questions? We have all kinds of committees. We don't have any more. So we have committees going, coming and going, and the roads are bad, so the metro people haven't been able to come. Okay. Well, thanks, Kevin, and we'll take up the bill, the whole everything later on.
Very well.
So, okay.
Thank you.
Maybe what we could do is can the zoo people start with the presentation, or who has to leave? The people from the zoo have to leave early. Yeah, you have a meeting, is that right? Okay. Minnesota Zoo, welcome. Minnesota Zoo administrators, welcome. And I think that House File 2504, Madori will be coming soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lee Emke. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Zoo. And
welcome.
Thank you. We're here to talk about two bills. The original bill that was introduced, 2504, is for asset preservation funding for the Minnesota Zoo. The Minnesota Zoo is approaching our 30th birthday, and we have a lot of deferred maintenance items at the zoo. This request will cover a portion of the identified needs. There's a handout that's being passed around now that lists in priority order repair and major maintenance items at the zoo. And so the request is for $15 million to begin to address the $30 million worth of deferred maintenance items at the state zoo facility. This represents kind of a continuation of, I would guess I'd say, a traditional $10 million request that we've put in over the last several bonding cycles. And it includes additional monies because of last year's bonding bill that included an allocation for inflow and infiltration, water management work at the zoo that affects the city of Eagan. $1.5 million was included in the bill last year that was vetoed, so we now have a better sense of the cost of the remediation, so that's been included in the $15 million request. The second bill,
132-56,
addresses our master plan design and construction request. The two boards that you see next to us here represent the zoo's master plan for redevelopment. We have initiated a number of projects. We'll be opening one of them called Rush's Grizzly Coast that was funded generously by the legislature 2 years ago. But we'd like to continue our quest to become one of the top zoos in the country, and are now in the process of raising private funds to continue the momentum that's been generated by the state funding. But we do need additional monies at this point to continue the planning and design of the master plan, specifically for a new visitor center, a new main entry and education center for the zoo, anticipated to be about a $30 million project, and we're seeking the planning, design, and project management funding to continue to move ahead with that project.
Okay. Well, thank you. And the governor recommended, the governor's recommendation is was it $5.5 million? $7.5 million.
$7.5 million, okay. For asset preservation.
Okay.
Importantly for us is receiving some level of support for the planning for the master plan, because right now we are seeing very significant momentum in our private fundraising. Our boards have committed over $5 million towards the continuation of the master plan. We've received several million-dollar grants from major municipal corporations. And this is momentum that we see as a public-private partnership going forward. So the planning funding, some level of planning funding this cycle would be
important. You asked for 5 minutes.
Correct.
All right. Anybody else? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I see Representative Hoffman is here, and then Cornish after. I think I saw Representative Cornish after. Who came in, maybe it's left or there he is. Welcome, Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having me.
Hoffwell, 2481, Como Zoo Infrastructure Funding Provided, Bonds Issued, and Money Appropriated. Go ahead.
When we come before committees here, we are fairly certain that absolutely everybody has at some point been to these two gems that are in Como Park, the zoo and conservatory. And if you've been to Como recently, you might have enjoyed a past investment that the state made in our visitor center and rainforest garden. This new facility has increased visitorship substantially. Over the last few weeks, you perhaps have read about us in the newspaper, over one other new state investment, and that is the new polar bear odyssey that was supported in past bonding bills. We successfully have now found a home for the polar bears while that construction happens. This exhibit that the state was a partner in is already winning national awards for the educational, environmental, and growth opportunities it will provide polar bears, which are becoming an endangered species. That project is on time and on budget. And then the bill before you today is the second phase of Como's plan for major renovation. This primary exhibit will have many of the same attributes of the polar exhibit. Improved holding areas, extended outdoor seasons, real grass and trees, and enough space for a gorilla family and not just bachelors. If you've been there recently, you know that I think probably as safety, we had to put up some boards that you now lift your children up above to so that they're able to see the exhibit. So those are the kinds of improvements that will happen. With me today is Mike Tom, director of the Como Park Zoo and Conservatory.
Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Tom. I'm the director and campus manager at Como Park Zoo and Conservatory. I want to thank the committee and the state for its past support. Como is a proud partner with the state of Minnesota. We work very hard to deliver a good return on the investment that the citizens of the state of Minnesota provided to Como. A little bit about Como, we serve 1.7 million visitors annually. Only 16% of those visitors are from the city of St. Paul. The balance, or 84%, is from the outside of the city of St. Paul. Representative Hultman referenced the past investments. The most recent investment the state made was $19 million for the visitor center improvements. That past investment leveraged $7.5 million in private funding for those projects. The request we have before you is for $11 million. Phase two of projects that were funded in the 2006 session. This will leverage $8.5 million in private investments that our nonprofit is in the process of raising right now. $800,000 is to complete the order odyssey that Representative Olson described. The remaining 10.2, which is in needed improvements for our gorilla habitat. Polar Bear Odyssey, we are opening bids next Wednesday. We're set to start construction in April. That project remains on time and on budget, and we're finalizing plans to send Buzz and Neil, our polar bear, to Detroit at the end of March. The gorilla project, which is my right, is the balance of this funding. It is the next step in completing our master plan revitalization of Como. This is an important investment for Como and Minnesota to continue to have gorillas as part of our collection in the state of Minnesota and important conservation efforts. A couple project elements, and these are consistent with both projects.
Excuse me, somebody has a cell phone on. It interferes with our system here, and we can't record. The meetings have to be recorded. So check your cell phone and shut them off, please. Thank you. All right, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, both projects have low improving environment for the collection while preserving that no-to-node experience that people associate with Como. In the case of gorilla, it will be three times the size of the current habitat. My hand pretty much sits over the existing gorilla exhibit that's there now. What this will create is a world-class gorilla habitat, have improved holding areas for the gorillas, have improved training areas. It's specifically important for gorillas because cardiac care, the ability to monitor blood pressure and cardiac health is important for lowland gorillas. Will allow us to create a mixed species exhibit, introduce some other primates with the gorillas, allow us to have a gorilla family and potentially 10 gorillas. We'll extend the season so the gorillas will be able to be outside on public exhibits for a greater portion of the season. Again, I'd be happy to take any questions. I want to thank the committee for their support and thank Representative Hausman for the support of our project. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any questions? All right.
Thank you very much.
Representative Mallory, we did your bill. If you want to do it all over again, okay. You have, I guess. Let's see. You have an amendment that we just incorporated.
We didn't.
Yeah.
So it was moved and voted on already.
No. We just wrote it as an author's amendment. It will be in the bill.
Yes.
It will be the way you want it.
Okay. We don't need to take a vote or anything on that then, right?
No, not until later.
Okay.
We'll have the committee, the full bill before us later on.
Okay.
It was put into that bill.
Mr. Chairman, just to get just with regard to presentation of the bill, I just want to let you know how much I support this project. I've been down personally toured. I've been working with the zoo on some of the projects that they want, making sure that we're looking towards the future with this plan and not not only preserving what we have, but looking towards the future. So I really would highly ask the committee to support the bill.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I remember when the Minnesota Zoo was created back in the 70s. Okay, well, thank you. Anybody, I guess it's other, I don't understand this electronic stuff. I guess Any electronic thing that anybody has is causing the interference and causing that noise. So, or is it maybe something else? Maybe it's our system. Okay. Well, thank you. Representative Cornish. Welcome. Kappa 388, and then your bill, you have an amendment, and that was incorporated into your into the bill, the final bill.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I have to introduce it as a delete all or just whatever the proper.
Well, just explain the bill, and then we'll discuss the full bill later on, and the committee will.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, first of all, thank you for you and especially your staff with you for being so kind to us and arranging for us meeting today, and for some of you for coming down and the tour of Farm America earlier.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed it. I'll get there, though.
Mr. Chair and members, what this is a appropriation for $500,000 to the Ag Interpretive Center near Waseca, called Farm America, and it's for appropriation for structural improvements of the existing buildings and also interactive exhibits within the building. And I won't have a long oration here, just a short introduction. This was organized by the legislature and the governor in 1978. And we're kind of off in the distance there and trying to find our place where we're having trouble getting funding and appropriations, which we'll bring in the proper next year. But this is for the capital improvements here and badly needed money for purchasing up the buildings and some exhibits. So I'm going to introduce my trustee testifier today and let him take it from here.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Roy Johnson. I'm a volunteer member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center and an employee of Cargill Animal Nutrition over in Minnetonka. The Board of Directors has been pursuing a number of options for Farm America. It was established as the Agricultural Interpretive Center and has developed an extensive history of machinery, equipment, and the technology that has been used, because the mission of the center is to tell the past, present, and future of agriculture. And as our agricultural heritage, at last report, is still the second largest employer in the state of Minnesota, and about 54% of the land is used for agricultural purposes. As you will see from the handout, our focus is on education, on telling the story of the heritage of agriculture. I won't go through all of the slides, but you can take a look at some of the images we see. We have 2,000 plus students tour each year. What we are requesting this year is the opportunity to expand, with not only to restore some of the facilities, but also to develop some experiential exhibits. We've identified six key areas that we think are important to tell the story of the heritage of agriculture, both for our citizens and for tourists coming into the state. They include food safety, farm gate displayed understanding of food processing, biotechnology, land stewardship, stewardship of the water and the soil, as well as the development of machinery and equipment. So the intent of this support is to further that development so we can effectively tell the history of agriculture in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, or your testifier, Mr. Johnson, how does this compare to the Kelly farm? Is this a working farm, or is this you said education, is it basically you come in and you go to an interpretive center and you have classes there to learn stuff, or is it actually hands-on type, like the Kelly farm up in Elk River, they actually have you actually working there, and you come in and you be a part of the process of what agriculture was from the 1800s henceforward?
Both options are present at the Interpretive Center Waseca. It is a working farm. It's present on 120 acres of a 360-acre farm site. There is current productive agriculture taking place there. We also set up a variety of historical exhibits to see the past of agriculture And that was part of the intent of the Interpretive Center, is to show not only the past, the current practices, and then also what the future practices will be in agriculture to go forward. We have both options available.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I understand.
Mr. Johnson, how much of, you say you're from Cargill, how many other agricultural companies invest in this farm or entity that you have here?
As you look through the budget process, the legislature currently provides $128,000 per year. The private sector currently furnishes through grants, business support of various agricultural organizations and companies provides just about the same amount or slightly more at this time. We also have plans, of course, as we look at these developments, to seek additional support from the private sector to tell the story of agriculture.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, is there, you say 120 acres of 360, is there potential that you want to expand for more acreage on this site?
The original creation, there's a donation, and well, I'd have to check with Dr. Frederick on some of the specifics. The original donor made a provision, so the balance of the 360 acres is in a, I believe the term is a living trust, although I'd have to double check that exact term, so that at some point the center will also consist of the additional acreage.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. Dr. Frederick is here. He was the provost and chairman, chancellor of the Waseca campus, which University of Minnesota closed, unfortunately. We fought that, but didn't win. And his partner there, Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Dr. Frederick's brother was in the legislature here with us in the House from Mankato area. St. Peter. Okay. I guess Reverend Tom,
yep.
Why don't you take up all of your bills now? Welcome, Representative Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Do you want to take them in our order?
I'll take them in your order. I think it looks okay.
Okay.
It's kind of the same subject, which is this issue of digital conversion that's being thrust upon us with federal deadline. For those of us who only recently moved from a black and white television set, it's pretty threatening. But it's more threatening to the people who have to manage this conversion on a fast track with limited means. So I'm going to call the person I've been connected with who will then introduce the people who come to talk. So House file, and one of them I understand, the last one, 3269, was referred to the wrong committee by mistake, but we'll get it. We'll get it to you before.
Okay.
So for the first one, House file 1181.
I'm Bill Krasinski, representing the interests of Minnesota Public Television, but I do have Al Harmon from the Duluth Public Television Station and Dan Thomas from Twin Cities Public Television Station to make the presentation.
Okay. All right.
And Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment to the bill. I don't know.
Maybe you could. We can just incorporate it later. Yes.
I'll just explain the amendment
and then
cut the amount that we're asking.
Oh, right. From 14 million to 6.5?
Yes.
Wow.
You got everyone to do that.
Yeah. Is that Alice Hoffman? Hoffman will like it. Okay, welcome.
And she will introduce ourselves. I'm Dan Thomas, Chief Operating Officer of Twin Cities Public Television.
And I'm Al Harmon, President and General Manager of WDSC-TV, the public television station serving Northeastern Minnesota from Duluth.
Okay, welcome.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are here to talk about House File 1181, but I think first it would be appropriate for us to thank the committee for VCTV, the Digital Television Transition Funding that was provided in the last session of the legislature, and also the special operating appropriation that was provided in the last session. That special operating appropriation help support local services by the public television stations serving the state, including things like Lakeland News, serving the Bemidji area, some fitness connections, some new local programming that they've produced. And I know for all the stations was important in providing a little bit of a cushion when we learned just a couple months ago that our federal appropriations would be reduced from the amounts that were originally appropriated. So our appreciation to you, Representative Jarvis, and to Representative Tom, and to the others who made those appropriations possible. And I would be remiss if I didn't note that we would certainly hope to make those base those increases part of the base budget for 2010-2011. The bill before us today, House File 1181, provides needed funding to meet the federally mandated transition to digital television broadcast. And kind of looking back, we've been telling members of the legislature that this transition is coming for almost 10 years. It's here now. This past holiday season saw strong sales of digital television. On Tuesday, the Federal Communications Commission required all broadcasters to file their plan for transitioning to digital broadcast by the February 2009 deadline. And since January 1st, consumers have ordered 5.8 million coupons that will provide a federal subsidy for the purchase of DTV computer boxes. And, you'll find in the handout, this first page describes that coupon program. What's significant about it is that boxes like these, there are some 40 different models that are now approved for the program, will start showing up in retailer stores. There are some 9,700 retailers signed up nationally to distribute these converter boxes, including such sort of Minnesota stalwarts as Target and Best Buy, also Radio Shack and Walmart and others. Available at retail prices of $40 to $80 and subsidized by a $40 coupon from federal government. So it's this box that will really make digital television accessible to citizens of Minnesota. So the transition's coming. As broadcasters, Minnesota's public television stations have to be ready, and certainly state health is important to us. This is a mandatory transition. It is expensive. The third sheet of your handout shows that earlier appropriations by the Minnesota legislature of about $8 million were leveraged with $12 million of federal money and $4 million of local funding to enable us to get on the air with digital broadcasting. The appropriation that we seek now will allow us to continue our local service to citizens of Minnesota by allowing us to produce local programming in addition to passing through programming from national sources. The handout that you have before you that shows some of the samples of equipment costs for high-definition production equipment will give you an idea of the sort of expense that each of the six stations serving Minnesota face in accomplishing this transition and being able to continue our tradition of local production and local service. Timing for this bill is critical as we approach not only the deadline for digital conversion, which comes February 2009, we are also approaching rolling deadlines that are limiting our funding access to funding. This will be the last session of the legislature before the digital transition is mandatory. Friday, tomorrow, is the last date that stations will be able to apply for federal matching funds for funds from the Federal Department of Commerce. And so we are really kind of rolling up to the end of our opportunities to be able to put together the funds that are going to enable us to provide continuing service. While we talk about dollars for technology and boxes and TVs and the like, what we're really talking about is an investment in the service to our community. Examples such as legislative coverage, which is now available to citizens statewide free over the air, part of perhaps the most visible result of the DTV transition appropriation that was made by the legislature last year. Each of the public television stations has made a commitment to supporting Homeland Security, providing hidden programming in our digital program stream that will provide information to first responders and public safety officials. Our recently completed rollout of the Minnesota Channel provides additional programming to minority and underserved communities that are really too small to attract the attention of commercial broadcasters. And we've got some kind of exciting new uses that we're promoting right now in Duluth. WBSC, working in cooperation with the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board, University of Minnesota Duluth, and the ESCO school system, is providing a system of delivering programs to the school that are not accessible to the general public. Those programs are then recorded on computers in the school and are available for use in classrooms at the discretion and convenience of the classroom teacher. But rather than talk about these kind of services, we thought it was perhaps most important to show you some of them. So Dan is going to do that and show you what's available from PPP right now.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. I want to start by echoing Mr. Harmon's comments and just thanking the committee, you, Representative Jaros, you, Representative Kahn, for your great support of public television. This transition began 10 years ago with the federal government saying all broadcasters must build out digital transmission facilities. We're turning off the analog transmission facilities in less than a year. And I'll start by showing you where we are in this digital transition. We are on the air with more services than ever before. That's the great news about all of the work and all the expense associated with this transition. So the little TV over in the corner here has hooked up to it one of the converter boxes that cost somewhere around $60. You can see that you can be receiving digital television. You don't have to have a fancy new high-definition set. You can be using your standard television set. The good news is that where in this community, TPT has been broadcasting two channels. Channel 2, which is the one you go to for children's programming and primetime PBS specials, and Channel 17, which has had radar weather, legislative coverage, and primetime reruns of those PBS specials. In the digital world, we are broadcasting seven channels, so more services than ever before. The first channel here is the Channel 2 service that you are used to seeing. Children's programming in the morning, adult programming like NOVA, American Experience, Frontline in the evening. It's the best of local and national programming. The next channel is a high-definition service. Now, without a high-definition set, you don't get the full benefits of high-definition picture quality and sound quality, but there are wonderful specials being produced by PBS and by TPT in high-definition, and you can still watch them here on a standard definition television set with this converter box. The next channels include the Channel 17 service that you're used to seeing. So right now it's on legislative coverage. This channel will actually, at the transition point, go away and be replaced by a different service because we will have a dedicated channel for local content that carries the legislature, and we will have a dedicated channel for radar weather. This is the Minnesota Channel, and we'll pause here to talk a little bit about this because this is an initiative TPT has been working on for 5 years. It's about an all-local content channel produced in partnership with many nonprofits across the community, over 150 public service organizations. We've worked with large academic institutions, small social service organizations like the Courage Center and Neighborhood House. It's about shows on local culture and local issues. You may know that we have a series that will be premiering on the Minnesota Channel in just a few weeks called Closing the Gap that was done in partnership with the Itasca Project. This is a series that's about looking at the gap around race, around class, around place that is in our community right now. The Itasca Project tackled this by doing Brookings Institute research and published the statistics. Well, public television can make those statistics come alive. In this five-part documentary series, we'll meet the people that are affected by these gaps, and we will see the social service organizations that are doing great work in helping them. So this is one of the benefits of local production and being able to produce a local channel. The next service is a full-time kids service. Undoubtedly, one of the most important things public television does is around early childhood education. And we've been doing it for decades. Think of Sesame Street. The programs on PBS for children are all about preparing kids for school. They're aimed at preschool kids. And this is a channel now that will have those programs available all day. Every day. And so it's not about looking for those shows around the other types of programming that we have to squeeze into a channel right now. The next service is a service called Create, and this is a lifelong learning channel with programs on cooking and gardening and those kinds of things. And the seventh channel is a full-time radar weather channel. So seven channels where there have two. So this is the great story about this digital transition that's been so difficult. What we're asking for now are the funds to complete the conversion of our production facilities. The funds we received last year were great and allowed us to do wonderful things. We've connected the six Minnesota public television stations for the first time. That's what allowed us to take the Minnesota channel that TPT is putting together and distribute it to all the other stations. The legislative coverage within the Minnesota channel is now being broadcast over the air for free for every household in Minnesota. The $6.5 million that we received last year was also very helpful in getting us partway in converting our production equipment. What it's all about now is being able to produce local content. It's about converting old analog equipment, putting in place new digital switchers, new digital cameras, the equipment that will help us produce local shows. The handout that Mr. Harmon pointed out to you shows that it's about $2 to $2.5 million per station for that conversion. So total is over $13 million, and we're asking for $6.5 million this year. I want to conclude by just reminding you of something I'm sure you already know, and that is that public television is very highly valued by the citizens of this state, and it's highly used. I'll start by pointing out to you there's a Roper poll that has been done every year, and as it was most recently done, this is a national poll, Americans were asked what they considered to be the best use of tax dollars, and public television came in second only to military defense. The same poll asked Americans to rank the most trusted national institutions in the United States, and what did they rank first? Public television. Now, in Minnesota, there is a lot of public television being watched. Use of public television in Minnesota is amongst the highest in the country. Over 2 million people a week tune in to a Minnesota public television station. And I'll say that again because I think it's an amazing statistic. Over 2 million people a week tune in to education, entertainment on public television. Yet Minnesota ranks near the bottom of the 50 states for its state support or state funding of public television. This committee has been wonderfully supportive of us, and we're counting on your support again as we take the last step towards completing our digital transition. As you can see, it's not about equipment. It's about providing better services and more services to the citizens of the state. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Well, it was well explained. Thank you. Have a good day. Your second bill, House File 3174, Minnesota Public Radio, digital conversion funding.
Again, continuing the same sort of problem. I do have one comment that legislators might appreciate on the public television. At one point, when we first started broadcasting, I got a comment from a former legislator and a former lobbyist. He said, well, he says, wow, I was watching the session last night. It would be amazing how much better it is in bed with a glass of red wine.
Wow.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you.
Might be better than digital conversion.
Liquid conversion. My name is Nancy Hilden with Bay Green Benson. Thank you very much for the opportunity this morning to present to you the request for funding from Minnesota Public Radio. And we have today here two folks that are going to make the case for this funding. Jeff Freeland Nelson, who will become much more familiar to you over the coming years. He's the new face at the Capitol of Minnesota Public Radio. And Lisa Wiegand, who is from Brainerd, and is here to speak to you to make the case.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome, Lisa. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lisa Wiegand. I am a longtime resident of the Brainerd area, and I am a dedicated listener and a member of Minnesota Public Radio. I'm also the volunteer chair of Minnesota Public Radio's advisory council in the Brainerd region. And I'm here today to ask you to support Minnesota Public Radio, and I give you my unbiased opinion that NPR is vital to me and hundreds of thousands of citizens in greater Minnesota. NPR is our best source for statewide news, information, and cultural programming. It's part of a great tradition of civic engagement in our state, and it keeps all of us informed about issues and ideas that matter to the citizens of Minnesota. And most importantly, particularly on a day like today, NPR makes these winters bearable on outstate Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio is asking for one-time federally matched funds to complete its transition to a digital signal statewide. Much like public television, this transition is crucial to the future of public radio in our state. Thanks to your past support and to federal matching funds, 17 Minnesota Public Radio stations in greater Minnesota have already been converted to digital. The appropriation I ask you to support today would fund the remaining 12 stations. And two of these stations are in Brainerd, KVPN, which is 88.3, and KBPR, 90.7. A digital signal will help to provide the Brainerd region with better and more reliable service, and is the first step towards increasing the programming offered by NPR in greater Minnesota. Why does this matter? Well, a few years ago, Brainerd did not have an NPR news station, so many of us had to try to tune in the NPR station from Collegeville. This usually involved some sort of effort with duct tape, makeshift antennas, tin foil. I actually had a friend who had to leave her microwave door open in order to get NPR news coverage before we had the news station in Brainerd. Not getting NPR was really like being cut off from the rest of the world. No one else covers the news in Minnesota better. No one provides more thorough coverage of what happens here at the Capitol. And NPR is indispensable to those of us in greater Minnesota that rely upon public radio to connect us to what is happening throughout the state. I often travel around the state, and I count on NPR everywhere I go for news, weather, and entertainment as I drive. NPR's regional coverage through Main Street Radio is an important part of why NPR is valuable to me. I moved to the Brainerd area in the early 80s, and like many city folks, thought that life ended after the metro region passed me in the rearview mirror. Much to my great surprise, there are a lot of interesting things that happen in greater Minnesota, and NPR is really the best source for news about those events. It's one of the few ways those out-state resources get publicized and understood. It's really good for rural economies, and it's good for tourism in Minnesota. I urge you to support Minnesota Public Radio's efforts to continue bringing high-quality public radio service to greater Minnesota and to finish the digital conversion project that they started last year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Jeff Nelson from NPR will give you an overview of our digital project.
Welcome.
Terry Arros, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Nelson. I'm public affairs director at Minnesota Public Radio, and I live and work here in St. Paul. I'll give you a brief overview of our digital conversion project and also other work that NPR is doing throughout the state, and then we can both answer any questions. Minnesota Public Radio reaches approximately 850,000 listeners weekly through our three radio services in the state. Those listeners tune in on average 8.5 hours per week. In greater Minnesota, more than 250,000 listeners tune into NPR each week. We also employ about 350 people throughout the state. Throughout the years, NPR has worked diligently to maintain, improve, and expand public radio service in greater Minnesota, where the population density is lower and fundraising is more difficult. This includes 29 stations from Duluth, Fergus Falls, Grand Rapids, and Grand Marais to Thief River Falls, Bemidji, Brainerd, and Moorhead. This summer, thanks to the support of the state of Minnesota, NPR will begin broadcasting from a new full-power wide-area service station in the Roseau-War Road region. Digital conversion is the single largest capital project Minnesota Public Radio has undertaken in greater Minnesota. Our goal is to provide the entire state with the same digital service that is now available in the Twin Cities. It will improve the underlying infrastructure of our entire network, provide high-quality audio to listeners with digital receivers, and eliminate many interference issues in areas that currently have a marginal analog signal. The legislature appropriated $2 million during last year's session, which we have received $2 million in federal matching funds. Together, this is paid for the digital conversion of 17 greater Minnesota stations. We are requesting the final $1 million from the state to be matched by federal funds and used to complete the digital conversion of the remaining 12 stations in greater Minnesota. This will include stations in Appleton, Brainerd, DeBuell, Virginia, and Hibbing area, Fergus Falls, Grand Marais, and Thief River Falls. This one-time federally matched funding will complete the digital conversion of all NPR stations. We estimate the total cost of digital conversion for NPR will be about $6.9 million. $6 million of that will be in greater Minnesota. We hope to receive $3.1 million in federal matching funds. NPR uses its technical infrastructure across the state for important services in addition to radio broadcasting. We play a key role in the public safety of all our residents. There are four services uniquely provided by NPR. With its network of stations, Minnesota Public Radio serves as a backbone for the state's emergency alert system, commonly referred to as EAS and formerly known as the Emergency Broadcast System. NPR provides the signals in the event of an emergency to all other radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across Minnesota. Minnesota Public Radio also plays an important role in the safety of our state's most important resource, our children. By serving as the radio backbone to the state's Amber Alert system, we provide Amber Alerts to all other radio stations, television stations, and cable providers across the state. NPR also provides the special subcarrier signals for the radio talking book, a reading service offered by the Minnesota State Services for the Blind. Since 1968, Radio Talking Book Service has broadcast readings of current print newspapers, books, and periodicals for those unable to read print publications. In addition, NPR serves as the sole backup network operations center for National Public Radio and our country's public radio satellite system. In the event of an emergency or disaster in Washington, D.C., this backup system is capable of quickly coming online and providing continuity for all public radio stations across the country. We're extremely grateful for the public-private collaboration that has made Minnesota Public Radio what it is today. We look forward to expanding our mission of community service well into the future. Thank you for your time and attention. We're both here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is perhaps more of a comment than a question, but also, first I'll start with a little bit of a question part, and that is just how much further will the signal go to some of those areas that still have spotty signal. And this is out in northern rural Minnesota, because I know there are still times when if you even want to finish listening to a debate or something of public, you know, really public interest about the state of Minnesota, more of the local programming, one often does have to get in the car and drive to the end of the driveway in order to hear it all, which really cuts into whatever you're doing with preparing supper. There, you know, we still have significant holes up in northwestern Minnesota, so I'm just wondering how this will affect that, if it will. So if you could just address that, please. Thank you.
I'm Terry Arms, Representative Baylor. Unfortunately, digital conversion does not mean that we have bigger circles on the map. What it does mean is that those areas where you currently get an analog signal, if you get any analog signal, you'll get a much better digital signal, much like you saw with public television, how crisp and clean the digital picture is. If you're able to get an analog signal now, you'll get a much better digital signal with a digital receiver. Really, the only way for us to fill sort of the big holes we have in our map is to build new transmitters. The other thing that we are doing is we're working very closely with FCC to try to boost the power of our digital signal. Right now, our digital signal is much weaker than our analog signal. That's something that is restricted by FCC. We're trying to give them all of our engineering reports and work with National Public Radio and our colleagues in public radio throughout the country to prove to the FCC that the system can handle a much stronger digital signal. And if they approve us boosting that signal, then we will be able to expand the radio. So for right now, it's basically if you're able to get an analog signal of any quality, you'll get a much better signal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
One point, Mr. Chairman, I'm saying I think that's for all these are one time or something.
Right.
So
all right. Well, thank you very much. Will we do the AMPER?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations today, also known as AMPERS and Independent Public Radio. AMPERS is a group of 11 different individual public radio stations that operate as an association rather than a network. Minnesota is truly blessed with lots of public broadcast opportunities, and we are now the third group of stations you're hearing from. This is unlike anything else in the country. You're really blessed. And the people of Minnesota are avid listeners and supporters of all the public broadcasters in Minnesota. And I want to introduce you this morning, Kevin Barnes, our president. Kevin's with the KBEM. I do want to say this is for one-time money for the AMPERS group. We did not participate in last year's funding at all. And so none of our stations have yet been converted to digital, though one of our stations is taking advantage of a federal grant to do that. Only about half of the AMPER stations are qualified for Corporation of Public Broadcasting grants, and that's related to the size of their operation, the budget, and the number of employees. And I'll turn this over to our president, Kevin Barnes.
Welcome. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much for making the time. We're excited about the opportunity for the AMPER stations. I'm Kevin Barnes. I am with KBM Radio and serving as chairman of the board and president of AMPER this year. And with our stations, you'll find a history of intensely local programming has been key to these stations for many, many years. We're hoping and looking forward to the opportunity with digital conversion to actually extend and improve and expand our ability to intensely serve locally our community. A number of our stations are served by volunteers who act as programmers on the stations. They are also very often embedded in learning institutions in university settings where they work with students. So, part of the expansion to digital programming gives us many other opportunities to both serve the communities that we try to serve locally very intensely, and also our student communities. As an example, our student community at North High School that we work with is very excited to think of programming that we can do through digital that would be in addition to what we're currently doing. So this would be, we appreciate you considering this, so we're looking forward to being able to make this transition with the AMPERS radio station.
Okay, well thank you. Any questions?
Sir, I was thinking about it, but in the interest of time, I was just going to say, now I recognize the name that goes with the voice that I hear. And I'm listening to Phil Misson.
Right.
Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Kahn, for helping us with this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to emphasize again the importance of all three of these, the time limitations, the need to match federal funding, and the fact that this is kind of an invisible piece of construction that we can have all of them. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Kahn. I guess Representative Westrum is here. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Welcome, Representative Westrum. You have an amendment to House File 3070, and we'll be incorporating that into your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. This House File request and the amendment that will be added to it would ask for matching funds to help bring together a project that's being worked on in my district in Kensington, Minnesota. And you may know about the famous Kensington runestone and some of the bait that goes along with that surrounded whether it was authentic or real. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to tell you it's real, and committee members. But there's several in the local community of Kensington that want to make sure this heritage is preserved and is passed on to future generations as well as current generations to learn about the heritage of the Kensington area and the runestone. And so the money we're asking for is to help match capital expenses or capital requests for the Heritage Society, as well as some operational costs that we would be helping with from the state's perspective. And so today, one of the persons very active in this is Mel Conrad from Kensington, and I'll just let him testify a little bit about this project and its importance and our request.
Okay, thank you. Welcome, Mr. Conrad, isn't it?
Yes, thank you, Clay, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Melvin Conrad. I am president of the Kensington Area Heritage Society, amongst other things. I apologize for my voice. I'm recuperating from a cold, and I'm hopefully I'm non-contagious. The Kensington Area Heritage Society is a relatively new entity, but we have undergone extremely rapid growth in the last few years. We quickly reached a point in our maturity or in our age where we had outgrown any facility that was offered to us, whether it was in Kensington's community center or our own homes, and we decided that it was time in 2006 to begin looking for a facility that we could use as a museum. From about 2000 forward, there's been an increasing interest in what I call the discovery site of the Kensington Runestone, and I'm assuming that you all know about the Kensington Runestone, which is basically a stone with a inscription on it that tells a story about Norse explorers or settlers coming to West Central Minnesota in the year 1362, slightly before Minnesota became a state, obviously. But we are celebrating not only statehood of Minnesota, Minnesota statehood this year, this is also the 110th anniversary of the finding of that stone. So, you know, that kind of puts that into perspective. The discovery site was on a farm just north and a little bit east of Kensington, a couple of miles. Local people got together in the 1970s and helped raise the funds to purchase that farm and convert it into a park, turned it over to Douglas County. Douglas County Parks Department is now operating that park and doing, and they're doing some renovation work out there at the park. In our development of this museum complex, if you will, kind of fits in with the whole concept of being able to tell the story of the Kensington Runestones at the site, or at the discovery site. To me, it's akin to telling the story of the Alamo in the most logical place, or telling the story of the Boston Tea Party in the most logical place. So what we've done since, what our organization has done since we made the initial decision to look for a facility, we identified a property in town in Kensington that we felt would be quite appropriate for us. It's the old Kensington Creamery. We purchased the building. We had enough funds gathered and funds committed to purchase the building and begin the restoration or renovation of it so we can use it as, to bring it up to museum quality. Shortly after we were, you know, as a part of this fundraising activity, we realized that we weren't going to be able to accomplish this project alone, that it was going to require a considerable amount of funds. Kensington, the population, I think, of the village is something like 286. The population of the zip code is slightly less than 1,000. The town sits in the corner of four counties in west central Minnesota. The total population of that area is about 60,000. So for us to presume that we're going to be able to raise $1 million to $2 million for development of a museum complex is totally unrealistic. So we said, okay, if we can get the state to kick in a little bit and we can get the federal funds or federal funding to kick in a little bit, then we'll be able to accomplish this.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah. Representative Erdo?
Thank you. The one time that I saw the, thank you, Chairman, the one time that I saw the Kensington Runestone was in the museum in Alexandria. Is that where it currently is? Is there any plans, if it is, to move it? Can you move it to Kensington?
Well, it's unlikely that it will be moved to Kensington. It's been, the Chamber of Commerce in Alexandria has had possession of it for a number of years, and I don't know that it would be moved to Kensington. We would, I mean, I'll tell anybody, we would love to have it. It makes sense to us, but it's also important that it's being protected in the area. And Alexandria, we consider Alexandria a part of the Kensington area anyway. Might just mention our membership is just slightly over. We're a membership-based organization, and right now we're just over 150 members. But our members come from all across the state. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, you name it, we may have a member there, plus from across the country.
Mr. Chairman, so you just
told us that Alexandria is a suburb of Kensington. That's it, right?
That's one we're looking at.
Okay. I do have a model of a Kensington room still in my house.
Right? Good.
Well, thank you very much. Any other questions? There's a caucus, I guess. If we can wrap it up before that, we can. We don't have to come back to that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, just quickly, at one time I do remember, and I think we still have it. We have, because of the difficulty of judging all of these local appropriations, we had a grant program in the Historical Society to specifically then deal with local historical societies and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be eligible to be part of that?
We have a little bit of a snag because the policy of the Minnesota Historical Society is that any project that has started is not eligible for grant funding through them. And we have started this, we've started operations or work on the project. So that puts one snag into it. The other snag is that typical historical society grants are not going to be much more than $5,000 or $10,000.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Representative Webster.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for your hearing and considering this project. I'd be happy to visit with you. I know it's a lot of money, and if there's other ways we can work something out, I welcome the opportunity to discuss it, and Mel and I will talk about it as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
See you. Representative Slocum and the Historical Society. Mr. Archibald, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm delighted to bring this bill forward. I think it's a really important bill, obviously. I wouldn't be carrying it. To fund Fort Snelling for revitalization and some shoring up of some buildings that are starting to crumble, that are crumbling, actually, and are in dire need of help. Fort Snelling, we've all been there. We've visited Fort Snelling, either as students or as adults, and I have one really quick, funny story to tell you about my 85-year-old father, who sends out these diatribes each year around the holidays. I'm sure you've gotten them from your friends and neighbors, too. And my mom and dad traveled all over the place. They loved to travel. Well, one year, the entire letter was about Fort Snelling, because they'd been to Switzerland, they'd been to Germany, they did this, they did that. One whole year, it was all about Fort Snelling, and all of us kids got the phone call and said, if you haven't been there, you need to go there. It is so great, and what they do there is great. And what they do there is great. They teach kids, they show kids what the history was like and what it is about. I urge your support for this bill, and I would like to introduce my testifier, Nina Archibald from the Minnesota Historical Society.
Thank you. Welcome, Archibald.
Thank you, Representative Slocum, and thank you, Chairman Yaros, and members of the committee for hearing us this morning. Yes, I am here concerning Fort Snelling. We have a major bonding request before you. And I guess I'd like to begin with the reasons for doing this. Fort Snelling, as Representative Slocum has suggested to you, has huge significance. It has huge significance for all of us. It is, I think, Minnesota's most significant historic place. It became a National Historic Landmark in 1960, which is the highest designation that the federal government gives to historic places. It was our first national landmark. There are many stories to tell there. The confluence of the two rivers, the Mississippi and the Minnesota, that's the place, the sacred place, the place of origin of Minnesota's Dakota people. We, of course, are familiar with the 1820s fort that has been there for nearly 50 years now. What we haven't done a very good job of doing is telling the story beyond the 1820s. the story of Dakota origin, the story of slavery, the fact that Dred Scott, if you read the piece in the paper this weekend, you know, if you didn't know it before, that Dred Scott was at Fort Snelling, and that his presence in free territory was the essence of the argument that was made for his freedom, which ultimately failed in St. Louis, and a direct precursor to the Civil War. Also, Fort Snelling plays a big role in the Civil War. We have photographs that show the Minnesotans mustering outside of the Commandant's house on the ground at Fort Snelling. They were the first volunteers to go off to the Civil War, and they played an absolute crucial role in winning the Civil War, as they were at the Battle of Gettysburg, held the line, 35% casualties, and they held it for the Union. So in a way, the Union owes a deep debt to the state of Minnesota and to Fort Snelling in particular. The U.S.-Dakota War followed. Of course, the most, probably the darkest chapter in Minnesota history. As a result of that war, 38 men were hanged at Mankato. Over 1,000 people were incarcerated in the area below the fort. Many of them died, and ultimately they were removed from Minnesota. That's a very sad chapter in our history, but it's one we need to tell. Right up through World War II, Fort Snelling played an important role, with over 300,000 people going through Fort Snelling as they entered military service to serve the nation. We also know that Fort Snelling is proximate to our national cemetery, a place of remembrance for Minnesotans, and a place, ultimately, I would say, of both sacred and secular significance for our state. I know that many of you have visited Fort Snelling. You know that we have an underground visitor center that is a building that is failing. We have pumps going 24/7 to keep the water in abeyance. We now have 4 funnels installed in the main concourse of the building so that we at least catch the water and put it into buckets as it intrudes into the building. We are doing what we can both to take care of that building and to ensure that it's safe for people to be in it. The request we make for you this morning has 3 elements. First, and very important, is the stabilization and repair of historic buildings that have been entrusted to our care. I want to emphasize, Representative Yaros and members of the committee, that those buildings are state-owned buildings, and they are in desperate condition. We have looked at those buildings for our own use. Of the 4, we plan to use 2, one remaining mule barn and the ordnance building. The 2 large barracks buildings that you see from Highway 55 we've looked at very carefully as the possibility for our reusing them for the visitor center. The problem has been that it is cost prohibitive, a difference of some $12 million between that reusing them and the project that we are proposing today. So what we have for you today is a proposal that we stabilize those buildings, we take care of them, and prepare them for use by others. I also would point out that the interiors of those buildings are not really suitable for a museum or visitor center. We can talk about that more if you like. What we plan to do also, in addition to taking care of those 4 historic buildings, which is absolutely central to the Society's mission, is to create visitor amenities within the walled fort so that the fort will be accessible year-round. Right now, the fort is not accessible year-round, and we are anxious to make it so. And so we're talking about taking a couple of the buildings within the walled fort and turning them into classrooms so that we could bring students into that area, which I think will be fabulous. If you've been to the fort in the wintertime, you know that it's a magical place. We also want to do something that's very important, not very glamorous, but put in ADA-accessible restrooms. And the 3rd element of the project is to construct a new visitor center to replace the failing building. This project, the revitalization of Fort Snelling, has received appropriations previously, 2005 and 2006, amounting to $2.1 million for design. The architects working on the project are HGA, an architectural firm in Minneapolis. We've gone through an extensive design process. We have considered many options, and I think that the proposal that we bring to you today is a responsible vision for the future of this most important historic site, and I would underline responsible vision. This year, of course, is the state's 150th anniversary, and at 50 years ago, that was when the impetus for the development of Fort Snelling as we know it today occurred. People recognized that they needed to preserve that place and give a gift to the future of Minnesota. I think we now have an opportunity to pass on our history, to take the next step in instructing future generations, ensuring that they know our stories, and hoping that they will learn from them. So, Mr. Chairman, that really completes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer questions that any members may have.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Madore.
Thank you much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slocum and Ms. Archibald. I have to tell you, I took the capital investment tour with the group this summer, and I was just appalled at the way some of the buildings were left. We had staircases that were rotted. We had missing steps. There were window panes that were broken. There were numerous water cracks up and down these buildings. There's a lot of work to do, and if we don't get on top of it now, we're actually going to lose these buildings. And I just, this is a fabulous project, and I've seen it for myself, and I think it's time that we take action and not let another season go by with potential freeze cracks that could actually take down the building. That's how susceptible at this point it appears to me and to the folks that were at the tour that these buildings are. So I think we need to step up to the plate. Just wanted to give my support for the project. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to let you know I have some serious concerns about the placement of the visitor center as it relates to the critical area standards for the Mississippi River, and would like to see that matter addressed at some point in time. I know we have some testimony from a witness who's going to say a little bit about that, too. I don't need to hear it addressed now because we're running out of time, but I think that's a conversation that needs to be had.
Mr. Chairman, I would only, Representative, I would only respond by saying that we actually do meet all the guidelines. In fact, went through an extensive redesign process to ensure that we would.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Yarrow.
We have a person that wants to comment on this bill, Mr. Diamond. Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you please identify yourself for the tape?
Yes, my name is Tom Diamond. Just for the record, I'm speaking here just as a private citizen. I think it's real important to start by mentioning that I think there's universal agreement that there needs to be something done for asset preservation, and I would encourage asset preservation. That's a very important piece of this puzzle. I think there's also universal agreement that this site is one of the most important historical sites in the state of Minnesota, and one of the reasons why it has national landmark status. But what there is not agreement about, and there is a very strong difference of opinion on, and very important rule, is the construction of new construction within a national historic landmark and whether this proposal meets it. Again, I'm speaking here in itself, but I would read to you from the U.S. Department of Interior. It is the U.S. Department of Interior Secretary Standards who determine on whether a facility meets those standards. And as you heard here, it was very important to the author and others that this project meets the Secretary of Interior Standards. I will read to you what the United States Department of Interior and the National Park Service said about this. They say that, as you know, the National Trust listed Fort Snelling among its 11 most endangered historic places in 2006. As with the upper post historic buildings on the lower post, the area managed by the Minnesota Historical Society are lying empty and deteriorating. This area, however, faces another threat. It comes from the Minnesota Historical Society proposal to build a new modern-looking visitor center in the heart of the Cavalry Building. They go on to further say that the proposed new visitor center does not come close to meeting the Secretary of Interior Standards for new construction at a historic site. That is direct counter to what was just presented. And this is from the U.S. Department of Interior and it's dated February 1st, 2008. Second, every reason the Society raises to reject reusing Cavalry Barracks for their interpretive center could be used to argue against adaptively reusing historic buildings on the upper post and for new buildings that do not meet the Secretary's standards. They further go on to talk about that the state funded a new visitor center. There's a Section 106 process that is going on that is required as not part of the National Historic Preservation Act. So if you're concerned about historic preservation, this is part of the process, and it's an ongoing process. They state, the U.S. Department of Interior, if a state funded a new visitor center, then the opportunity to consider meaningful alternatives like the adaptive reuse of one of the historic buildings would most likely not be considered. I should also point out there's some other points in here. Level of significance. Fort Snelling is a national historic landmark and one of Minnesota's most important historic sites. The Minnesota Historical Society portion includes four historic buildings that are contributing to this NHL status. They are the Cavalry Barracks, 17 and 18, the Cavalry Stable, 30, the Ordnance Building, 22. Now, they also point out, and this is really important for people who may not be familiar, the Frontier Fort, I refer to it often as the Stone Fort, is largely a reconstruction, but there are some original elements. There are different names. I refer to them as the Stone and the Brick Fort. The Stone Fort, or the Pioneer Fort, it served a relatively short lifetime. It was essentially the fur trading days, the pioneer days. The brick fort is the cavalry fort. It served for the Western expansion. It had a very lengthy history. It had not only what they were talking about here, but the Spanish-American War, the World War I, World War II, all served from this facility. Characters or famous people like President Taylor commanded this facility. It was the Department of Dakota that was headquartered at this facility, which served the Western expansion development of the Western states, and individuals like Colonel Custard served out of this facility. It's quite a difference, and it's also important, again, to get back to, it's a cruel irony that they're proposing to build a new building that does not fit with the historic, within the actual historic building, that will harm and not provide reuse of the historic building. The Cali buildings are actually historic buildings. As I said, the stone fort is largely a reconstruction. It's a wonderful facility, don't get me wrong. Minnesota Historical Society is proposing to construct a new visitor center that will adversely affect the National Historic Landmark and set the wrong precedent for historic preservation for the National Historic Landmark, but also for adaptive reuse statewide. The design bears no resemblance to the Cavalry Barracks or the Ordnance Building or to any building that ever existed in the NHL. Furthermore, the Society proposes to place their new visitor center in a prominent location among historic buildings and near the bluffs. The majority of nominated and selected projects that will go into what they're talking about, the 2008 most endangered historic properties in Minnesota, will be buildings that need adaptive reuse. Largely, when we talk about the most certain buildings, we talk about adaptive reuse. By insisting that only a new building works for what it wants, the Society is setting a precedent that should be used against each of these nominees and against adaptive reuse statewide. This is a very important issue. Possible solutions to removing the threat. The best possible solution, as pointed out in this, is to convince the Society to withdraw its request and to pursue the adaptive reuse of one of the, or both, the Cavalry Barracks. If the Society will not withdraw its request, then the next best solution is to convince the Minnesota Legislature yourself to turn down their request for funding. I'll point out one other thing here, and thank you for the time. And that they talk about advocacy. They pointed out that, this is, again, the Department of Interior said that the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the Friends of Fort Snelling, and Friends of the Mississippi Railroad, and other organizations have tried to get the Society to reconsider the timeliness of the proposal and to allow for more thorough examination of adaptive reusing one of the Cavalry buildings. We don't have time, and it's not the place to get into a lengthy discussion of the proposal. That they said, well, we looked at the adaptive reuse of the buildings, but it's not, it's cost prohibitive. Well, actually, I do that for a living, historic preservation. And I saw the plans as others have, and they were clearly the Rolls Royce of the proposals. They not only was it exorbitantly expensive the way it was proposed, it did great harm to the buildings. It was a very poor proposal. As you know, when you get architects and designers involved in a project, you can have the thing go way off the track. Literally lose the wheel. And that's what was proposed and was pointed out. Instead of going back and looking at a way to adaptively reuse, and the Department of Interior believes that that can be done, and they have been involved in projects throughout this country, both themselves and overseeing, believe this can be done on this site. What I'm encouraging you to do is fund to the greatest extent you possibly can asset preservation on this site. It's a very important consideration. But to hold off on new construction of this site until the parties who are involved, including the Department of Interior, have had adequate time to review and look at alternatives. Because if you don't do it, not only the bad precedent, but just on this site alone, if you just, you know, do some extra work on asset preservation, but leave those buildings empty, and then build this new facility, there is not a reuse. And the Historical Society has not identified a reuse for those buildings, and, again, we don't have time, but the site does not allow, because there would not be parking and stuff for another user. So you can have these buildings that do not have a reuse, and we all know that empty buildings, even if they had cosmetic or even serious work to help preserve the exterior, if they don't have a tenant, the long-term viability of those buildings is really in doubt. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Question? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't have much time, so we don't have to come back, and we can just act on it. We have the, you have the delete all amendments. Okay, let's call the meeting to order. We have a quorum, so we can make actions on this bill. In your folders, amendments, delete all amendments, DE6. Does everybody have that? And we will direct that. We have a couple of technical amendments that we'll direct the staff to take care of. They're just technical amendments, okay? They have done most of them because they come last minute, but there's a couple of them that we have from Representative Westrum, and it was just a typo error, and the Representative Khan's digital TV bill. That's just a reduction from $14 million to $6.5 million.
And clarifying that everything at one time.
And everything, yeah, okay, right. Okay, and clarification that the appropriation, if and when it is done, will only be one-time appropriation. At this time, I would move that the amendment to House File 2703. And anybody that wishes to be a co-author, that's the Loose Zoo bill. We have to send this send it as a bill to the Finance Committee, and then it will go to Capital Investment Committee. Do you want me to go through the bill then now? And you have the sheet right here. Everything is in the bill. Okay. Do you want me to go through with it, or?
I don't think so.
No, because you've seen it.
Yeah.
You don't want to see it any longer. Okay. So, all those in favor of accepting the amendment to DE6, the final engrossment with the direction to the staff to take care of the technical amendments before the bill goes to the Finance Committee. Say hi.
Aye.
Opposed? Any discussion on the bill, which has become House File 2703, before we send it to House Finance Committee and then the Bonding Committee? All those in favor of House File 2703, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Well, thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you all for coming. Yes, Representative Riddle.
Yeah, any particular concerns or comments or things that you want to see, you know, really pushed in this delight curve on capital investment?
Well, you have.
I'd you know, welcome whatever comments you have, and
okay.
I think are strong. You know, you get a strong feeling.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. You have more to say about it than I do. Well, we'll adjourn until I believe we're going to have a meeting on Monday. We'll see. If there are any bills coming today, and we might meet on Monday, but we'll decide that later. Thank you very much for your time.